This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The illegal operations documented in the CIA files known as the Family Jewels are hardly the only illegal operations in the CIA's 60-year history. My guest, New York Times reporter Tim Weiner, has written a new history of the CIA in which he chronicles many covert, illegal, and misguided operations. He describes his book, Legacy of Ashes, as a description of how the most powerful country in the history of Western civilization has failed to create a first-rate spy service. Weiner has been reading The Family Jewels and reported on them yesterday in the New York Times. The Family Jewels are a collection of CIA memos written in response to a 1973 order from then-CIA Director James Schlesinger. After learning about CIA involvement in the Watergate break-in, Schlesinger ordered CIA employees to report on any activities the CIA had engaged in since 1959 that were outside of the authority defined by the CIA's charter. These just declassified papers document domestic wiretapping operations, failed assassination plots, and programs spying on anti-war groups and American journalists. Weiner says the biggest revelation for him and the Family Jewels is how much resistance there was within the CIA to carrying out orders to spy on Americans.
By 72, 73, 74, the last years of Richard Nixon, the officers who were commanded to spy on Americans, and specifically to spy on the anti-war movement, everyone in the spectrum from Another Mother for Peace to the Black Panthers, they began to rebel. They didn't want to do that. And they didn't want to, maybe the problem was they didn't want to grow long hair and beards and, you know, go tracking leftists around the world, because it wasn't their job. That isn't their job. Their job is to collect foreign intelligence abroad, not to spy on Americans.
Is there a memo within the Family Jewels that you consider to be gold, you know, something really special for people like you who have studied the CIA history?
Yeah. There's a couple of pages from one of the most mysterious people in the history of the CIA, James J. Angleton, who was, among many other things, the chief of the counterintelligence staff, the spy catcher, for 20 years, from 1954 to 1974. Angleton wrote a report on himself, really, in response to this order from the Director of Central Intelligence to report any violations of the CIA's charter. The charter of the CIA, which was written in 1947, is exceedingly vague, but it's clear on one point. You don't spy on Americans. Your job is overseas. One of the things that Angleton had done through his 20 years in power was to help set up secret police abroad. In many countries, the CIA and other American agencies like USAID, the Agency for International Development, would create in some cases, but train, arm, equip the police and military and internal security forces of third world countries all over the world. That would serve two purposes: to fight communism in Ecuador or the Philippines or South Korea or Bolivia. And also, these secret police units would collect intelligence for the CIA. Angleton had dropped a dime on himself by reporting that there might be a spot of bother here. There might be a flap, because we brought a bunch of these foreign secret police into Florida to be trained by the bomb squad of the Dade County Police in Miami. That, to me, was a moment in time that I was unaware of. It was news to me.
What was the point of bringing them to Miami to be trained by the bomb squad there?
Well, among the many things that the secret police of foreign countries created by CIA and other U.S. government officers, among the things they did was counterterrorism, to defuse a bomb. On the other hand, some of these secret police forces were themselves instruments of terror. and they made bombs. So you could read that either way.
You know, I think most of Americans are aware now that, you know, the CIA helped arm the Mujahideen, the Islamic fighters, against the Soviets who had invaded Afghanistan. What the CIA didn't realize was that those Islamic warriors would eventually turn against us. What surprised me in your book is that this kind of thing of, like, arming Islamic warriors goes back to the Eisenhower era. You write that Eisenhower wanted to promote the idea of an Islamic jihad against godless communism. He said we should do everything possible to stress the holy war aspect. So what kind of program did Eisenhower authorize the CIA to conduct?
The agency saw every Muslim political leader who wouldn't pledge allegiance to the United States of America as, quote, a target legally authorized by statute for CIA political action. And those are the words of Archie Roosevelt, who was chief of station in Turkey, and the cousin of Kim Roosevelt, who was the czar of the Near East at CIA. So how do you do that? Well, you can give them money, and most of the powerful men in the Islamic world who were allied with the United States in the 50s and 60s and 70s took the CIA's cash. Or you can give them guns, and we did that. So they delivered American guns and American money to King Saud of Saudi Arabia and King Hussein of Jordan and the president of Lebanon and the president of Iraq. And these four gentlemen were supposed to be our defense against communism and Arab nationalism in the Middle East. And that's how things worked. In many ways, that's how it still works.
Now you write that President Kennedy and Bobby Kennedy actually unleashed covert actions with unprecedented intensity. That you say they launched 163 major covert operations in less than 3 years. What are some of the more major but lesser known covert operations that they authorized?
Well, they did it, as John Kennedy would say, with vigor. Let me give you a flavor of this by sort of reciting from the Kennedy tapes. Now, here's a couple of typical weeks in the summer of 1962 in the Kennedy White House. And we know this because John Kennedy taped these conversations in the Oval Office. And you can listen to them and read them online. And the Miller Center in Virginia has a number of them. We've just posted one today at the New York Times that is shocking. On Monday, the 30th of July, 1962, President Kennedy walks into the Oval Office and he switches on this brand new state-of-the-art taping system he's installed over the weekend. And the first conversation he ever recorded was a plot to overthrow the government of Brazil. So that was July 30th. August 8th, he meets with the director of Central Intelligence, John McCone, to talk about dropping hundreds of Chinese nationalist agents into Mao Zedong's communist China. And they joke about, ooh, what happens if they get shot down? Maybe a U-2 spy plane will get shot down. Ha-ha, next month Mao's forces shot down a U-2. Next day, August 9th, Richard Helms, later the director of Central Intelligence, goes to the White House to talk about overthrowing Haiti. August 10th, John McCone, Robert Kennedy, and Defense Secretary McNamara meet at the State Department. Now, this one isn't recorded on tape, but it's on paper, and they're talking about liquidating people in the Castro regime, namely Fidel Castro and his brother Raul. August 15th, McCone goes back to the White House. This is on tape. Let's overthrow the government of Guyana. Good idea. August 15th, same day. Let's figure out how to set up paramilitary forces in Vietnam, Laos, and Thailand through the CIA. And while we're at it, Iran, Pakistan, Bolivia, Colombia, the Dominican Republic, Ecuador, Guatemala, and Venezuela. Here's a document about that, the director of Central Intelligence tells the president. It's very highly classified, says John McCone, the CIA chief, because it tells all about the dirty tricks. Ha ha, they say. A marvelous collection, says McGeorge Bundy, the national security advisor. A marvelous collection or dictionary of your crimes. And they all laugh. So that's the summer before the Cuban Missile Crisis. Just 3 weeks.
What's the shocking document that you referred to that was posted on the New York Times website?
Oh, more shocking than what I just said? a shocking document we posted on the website of the New York Times is a taped conversation with a transcript of President Kennedy and Director of Central Intelligence John McCone and two intelligence advisors talking about bugging the national security reporter for the New York Times, Hanson Baldwin, which they did. Presidents and directors of Central Intelligence should not bug reporters for the New York Times, in my opinion. We can irritate them, but they can't wiretap us. Those are the rules.
Now, you're right that President Johnson was haunted by President Kennedy's covert operations.
And none more than the effort, successful effort, to overthrow the president of South Vietnam, President Diem, which happened 3 weeks before JFK was assassinated.
Why did that haunt LBJ?
He thought the murder of John Kennedy was divine retribution for the killing of Diem.
He didn't think that Diem supporters were directly responsible for it. He just thought this was divine retribution.
That's what he said. He said it more than once. Look, this was a horrible event. The United States was trying to defeat communism in Vietnam, and it decided that the president of South Vietnam was no damn good, and so it backed a coup to get rid of him. And the CIA did not kill Diem, but it had a very prominent officer in the camp of the generals and the colonels who overthrew the president of the country that we were trying to support. And, you know, 9 coups followed in succession, and we eventually had to send 500,000 troops in, and we lost, 50,000-odd dead, didn't we?
Did Kennedy authorize any covert operations to spy on Americans beyond the journalist who you mentioned?
The spying on Americans really got started in a big way under President Johnson and continued under President Nixon, because LBJ was convinced as a matter of moral certainty that the anti-war movement in the United States was being controlled, manipulated, financed by the communists in Moscow and Beijing. Well, he was wrong about that. But he sicked the CIA on Americans to find proof of it. They couldn't find any, because there was none.
What did Helms have to say, who was then the head of the CIA, about being asked by his president to do something that Helms knew was illegal, because it goes against the CIA charter to use the CIA to spy on Americans?
He reminded the president of the United States that the CIA was not supposed to spy on Americans. Richard Helms wrote in his memoir that he looked the president in the eye and said, you know, we're not supposed to do this. And he says that Johnson told him, I'm quite aware of that. I want you to pursue this matter, and I want you to track down the foreign communists who are in the anti-war movement. I'm certain that LBJ expressed himself more pithily than that.
So how extensive was the operation?
It wasn't that great a job, frankly, because there wasn't any evidence to find. But they tried. The CIA is an institution with a military ethos. If the president of the United States gives you an order, you salute smartly, go back to your office, and now say, God almighty, what do I do now? The CIA reported to President Johnson that there isn't any evidence, Mr. President, that the anti-war movement is supported by foreign communists, and he sent them back, and he sent them back again, and he sent them back again. Presidents misused the CIA. Richard Helms, who was director for 7 years and was probably one of the better, if not the best, among the 19 directors of Central Intelligence, said that not one president, with the possible exception of George H.W. Bush, who after all ran the place for about a year, understood the first thing about the CIA or its secret operations. The history of the CIA is in large part a history of presidents who don't know the first thing about the CIA and who misuse it and abuse it and kick it. And the one who kicked it hardest was Richard Nixon.
You say that the collapse of the CIA as a secret intelligence service began on the day that Richard Helms left and James Schlesinger arrived. So what do you mean by that?
By the time Schlesinger left, later in 1973, the secrecy of the CIA was beginning to break down. Ronald Reagan tried to make the CIA secret again, but he made a huge mistake, which was to put his campaign manager in charge of the CIA, and that was the wily and devious William J. Casey. They tried to rebuild the CIA as a really secret, operating, covert arm of the United States government. And what did we get? They smuggled missiles to Iran, skimmed the money off to support the anti-communist guerrillas in Central America, and they got caught, which was a real black eye for the United States and for the CIA.
And that's Iran-Contra that you're talking about.
That I am.
What are some of the secret CIA operations that you fear we'll never really learn enough about because the documents were destroyed?
The mind control experiments conducted in the 1950s. There was a great fear during the Korean War that Communist China, North Korea, and the Soviets were taking captured American prisoners and turning them into zombies or robots. There's a movie about this called The Manchurian Candidate.
Great.
Which I recommend to your listeners. And the ethos of the time, and you had to have been there to understand it, was if they're doing it, we have to do it too. We have to fight fire with fire. So a number, how many, we'll never know, of programs were created with, you know, names like Project Artichoke to figure out if you could control another human being's mind. The techniques range from hypnosis to heroin, from sensory deprivation to LSD. In one case, they took a prisoner in the federal narcotics penitentiary in Kentucky and fed him LSD for 77 consecutive days. They failed, obviously. I mean, it's very hard to control another human mind. And anyway, that wasn't their job. Their job was to know other humans' minds, to know what foreigners were thinking. And the only way to understand what another man thinks is to talk to him.
So the documents from that experiment were destroyed?
One of the things that Richard Helms did when he left office after Richard Nixon fired him in a very uncouth way at the end of 1972 was to clean up his files. And among the files that were cleaned up was the paper trail of the mind control experiments that he and the director of Central Intelligence, Alan Dulles, had personally approved two decades before in the early 1950s. Very few of those records survived.
The CIA has been so criticized lately, in part because of its reports that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction when it didn't, because of the secret prisons that it started, and its use of what many people describe as torture and its interrogation programs. Do you think that this fits in with the earlier history of the CIA, or do you think that these recent things are something new in the life of the CIA?
The CIA does what it does, with very few exceptions, because presidents order it to do those things. The president of the United States ordered the CIA to use, quote, special interrogation techniques, unquote. It's not that the CIA stuck up its hand and said, gee, maybe we should torture these prisoners, you know, and see if we can get some information. Presidents need to know what the CIA can and cannot do. This president, the evidence will be clearer 10, 20, 30 years from now, appears to have pushed the CIA beyond the limit of its capabilities. You know, if presidents want to change the world, send in the Marines. But if they want to know the world, that is why the CIA was created 60 years ago. And you cannot undertake covert action or war without intelligence. We, as a nation, are and will remain a superpower. What we do is project our power around the world. You cannot do that without intelligence. It gets you into terrible trouble.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Terry, it's a pleasure.
Tim Weiner is the author of The Legacy of Ashes, The History of the CIA.